This is our instant reaction to the devil all the time. If you hear the clinking of ice in a glass, it's because I'm drinking bourbon in a 400 million degrees facility talking about the devil. And the inspiration for this instant reaction and for this bourbon in my glass is the first lady of binge movies now, officially, both the first lady to agree and actually show up on the show, and the Lady Juan, not a lady. We've never had royalty before. We have royalty now. She's in the house. She's the first lady of binge movies. I hope she doesn't mind me calling her that. And she turned me on to this thing called movie juice. There is no coffee in this because I am up late enough as it is. But it's just straight bourbon. And I haven't had bourbon in maybe 3 years. I have acid reflux now for the first time in 3 years. Thanks to you and our Twitter exchanges.
You're welcome.
Yeah. You seem to be like a night owl as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, guilty for sure.
Most of our conversations so far have taken place somewhere between the hours of 11 and 1 a.m. So, and one of them was about this movie, The Devil All the Time. And then we were like, hey, let's just make a podcast out of this. We're content creators. People have want to hear
Absolutely.
Our thoughts.
I hope so.
Introduce yourself to the fine binge lords at home. Who the hell are you? Other than the first lady of binge movies, who the hell are you? Why are you on this show? And where do you come from?
Man, I love the title. So I am the Lady Wan. That's W-A-N as in Obi-Wan. That's where my name came from. It was Star Wars inspired. I am the co-host of Screen Fix Podcast, a podcast where we fix a recent Hollywood film. The idea of fixing it is, you know, when you see a movie with your friends and afterwards you're talking about it and you're like, yeah, that was cool. But you're like, you know what they should have done? It's that. That's the show. We do not take ourselves seriously. We have fun with it. We love movies. We love throwing crazy ideas at the movies that we watch. So that's the show.
As we record this very recently, you had friend of the show, Colby Mack, on, who's just,
yes,
just a beast of a human being. And what was that experience like for you?
Oh, we talked Tenet with Colby.
I can only imagine.
Yeah. It was a blast. Colby and I both thoroughly enjoyed the movie and we geeked out. Like, the episode is edited, I have to tell you. There is cutting room floor. It's just audio of Colby and I being like, and then, oh my God, just screaming at each other. It didn't seem like it. It was adding to the show that we were both just like geeking out. So some of it got cut, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he
was a great guest.
So I'm glad that you're on. That means you're pretentious enough to think you could fix a Christopher Nolan film.
Which
I am as well, because we did a deep dive into the best movies of the decade. We have an Inception episode, and I've caught a lot of flack on the internet about that. So now I've been labeled a Christopher Nolan hater. I don't know how. All I said was
you had an opinion.
Inception is the beat for beat Nightmare on Elm Street, The Dream Warriors.
Oh.
It's the Dream Warriors. It's Dream Warriors, folks.
Man.
It's Dream Warriors. Christopher Nolan takes schlock material and he elevates it with a bunch of high-minded cinematography and directorial skills. The man's a genius, but his plots are B-movie plots.
Yeah, it's just dressed up in really fancy suits. I get it.
That's it.
He's just, it's all in the tailoring. He knows what to do.
I live in an area, I've been relocated to Akron, Ohio by the dark movie overlords. To open a video store in 2020. Doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, but here we are. And so I live in a community that movie theaters are kind of open. So you either live in a state that's really got its shit together or you live in a state that doesn't give a fuck. You don't have to tell us what state you're in, but...
I am in the most don't give a fuck state there is.
We'll let the people
I'm in Florida, man. It's wild out here.
Oh, God. So, speaking of wild, what was your tweet about this movie that inspired this? It was something like, I'm watching this movie. I kind of like it. I think I might hate it. Was it something like that?
What did I say?
It was a gist. Hold
on. What did I say? Like, and how far back do I have to go 2 days in my Twitter? Like, how sad am I? Like, how much am I talking? Probably
too much.
Gotta
get that brand out there.
Oh, man. I just can't help myself. I said, I don't know how to feel about the devil all the time. I hate what I'm watching, but also I think I like it.
Yeah, those were like, I watched it the day that Ginsburg died. And I tweeted, this is the worst weekend to watch this movie. The only other movie that I think would have been the worst movie to watch would have been I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which was their last instant reaction.
Yeah.
So for those who don't know, The Devil All the Time is an adaptation. It's a film adaptation of a book by the same name by Donald Ray Pollock. Pollock is the narrator, which was my guess. I'm like, I think the guy that is doing the narration is the author. And I Googled it, and I was right, because I'm smart about movies. It's directed by Anthony Campos, with a screenplay by Antonio Campos, I'm sorry, and Paulo Campos. It stars Tom Holland, Bill Skarsgård, Jason Clarke, Sebastian Stan, Haley Bennett, and Robert Pattinson, of all people, and among others. And that's just like the top billed people. Yeah. We will go into full spoilers. This is one of those movies. It's a little art housey. You can only talk about it in terms of spoilers. The bourbon is out, so you know this is going to be some egg-headed shit. So this is, you're going to get some dime store film school knowledge from me. So, and the Lady of Wands here to give you that the real film criticism. So let's start with you. What the hell is this movie? What is it about? What did it make you feel? All that good stuff.
Well, first, I have to say, I did not know this movie was out. Like, I missed all the hype about it beforehand. And the reason I found out about it is because one of my show listeners, Dusty, who likes to DM us on Instagram, said to me, I'm watching this movie on Netflix with Spider-Man and the Winter Soldier and Pennywise and Jason Clarke and Batman. And dang, nobody in this movie is good. I mean, the acting is good, but everyone is a bad guy. And I was like, what is this movie? I need to watch it now. Like, that was how it was described to me. And he gave me the name and I was on it. I was like, I need to see this immediately. And he was right. It's good acting. Everybody's a bad guy. It's intense stuff. Like, I was watching it and it's just a series of terribly unfortunate things. Just, I'm just
it
like,
really
how
is
this? What? Oh, no. Like, everything
it's a
that
series
happened,
of
like,
unfortunate
oh, no, no, no,
events.
No. It is tough stuff. But the whole time I was thoroughly engaged and like very much enjoying what I was watching, even though it was horrible to watch. I don't know how to explain that. Like,
well, this movie
I stand
is,
by my tweet.
Yeah, this movie has gotten like destroyed by the Rotten Tomatoes crew. It's got like a 65% or something, which is kind of surprising to me. And people really don't like it. They don't like the pacing. It is, I think it's 2 hours and 18 minutes.
And
this raises my first question. This is maybe a more global question, but do you think it's possible that Netflix and like serialized dramas have rewired our brains to where we like these sorts of stories, but we only expect them to be, you know, in 10 episodes, like a True Detective or Mindhunter or something like. We like these, because what it is the movie is essentially like a series of vignettes that are kind of leaping forward and backwards in time. It's told sort of non-linearly. It's really about Tom Holland's character, I guess, and this group of people between these two hick towns and the Appalachia of Ohio and Appalachia, West Virginia. And part of it's in a holler and then the highway in between. And everything that could possibly go wrong, seemingly in all of these people's lives, does. And it's about like the profane and the sacred. And it's about faith and religious fanaticism. And it's about men and power and control and sex and Pepsi cups and all kind of weird shit. Oh, if you've ever wanted to see the Winter Soldier, get a dry HJ and a police car into a Pepsi cup. That's how he's introduced. I was like, oh boy, a bloated Sebastian Stan in a deputy sheriff uniform, getting a very awkward old fashioned. I was like, oh, we're in for it. Where this is going to be a thing. This is going to be a movie. That's a choice. This is how you introduce this character. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
And then that's not the kinkiest thing in this movie. There's some kinky, weird shit in this movie.
Yes.
And so are people not responding to it because they're forced to watch it continuously for 2 hours and 18 minutes as opposed to, okay, here's 45 minutes or an hour of it, and I can either choose to continue on or not? Is that part of the problem, you think?
I don't know. It might be, but I do feel like people binge shows that are like that. I mean, when I started watching, a few things during quarantine. I'm putting air quotes around it because Florida.
Yeah, we've already determined.
But I was good. So I started watching a few things. Actually, at the beginning of this, I was like, I'm going to watch really depressing stuff because I want some perspective. And so I watched like There Will Be Blood, and I watched Midsommar, and I started watching Breaking Bad for the first time. I was like, I want to see people be like terrible, and then I'm going to feel good about what's happening. And then, you know, like, unfortunately, the world got more terrible during quarantine, and I was like, never mind, this doesn't help. Back to Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So like I had to like lighten it up. But I don't know, because I really do feel like people dive into shows and they're willing to sit in front of their TV for 5 hours. And just because credits break it up every hour doesn't, you know, I don't know.
I 100% agree with that. But the common criticism I see for longer movies is it was too long. Mm. And so then my brain goes, okay, you're going to watch 6, 8, 10 hours of a TV show in one sitting. But 2 hours is too long for a movie. 2 hours and 18 minutes is too long for a movie. And I think for this movie, for particular, is the pacing is part of it. We're in a post-World War II hillbilly backwoods thing. Like, and so I think the pacing is getting us into the vibe of this slower. I mean, even the way they talk is slower. It's that long drawl. Mm-hmm. We could talk about the accents and the choices that were made. And there's a certain rhythm to the life of these people. And I think if it had this frenetic pacing, it was just like constantly moving forward, I think it would kind of betray the story. I think the pacing was intentional to sort of, it was drawn out on purpose.
Yeah. I don't feel like this movie felt too long. I have seen plenty of movies that felt too long. On Netflix and in the theaters. Project Power was too long for what it was. That was a Netflix release earlier this summer. But this one, it felt like the right amount of time to me. And I was actually watching an interview with the director earlier, and, you know, he said there's not like, sure, there's removed footage. Like, yes, I edited it down, but there's not like a 2.5 hour cut that I think is better than this. Like, this is the cut that I really thought was best. So I don't think it's too long. And to counter people, you know, willing to binge like a long show, like a 10 episode like anthology, I've been going through that with Fargo, and some of those episodes, nothing happens. And I'm like, well, that was just a waste just because you stretched the season. So I'll say, to counter the idea that people are willing to watch like a longer drawn out story in a TV season, I've been watching Fargo, and some episodes during the seasons, nothing happens. There's like 2 minutes of action, and then it's a whole drawn out thing. So TV shows are definitely guilty of stretching to hit the episode number. I think more guilty than a lot of these movies are. But I thought the pacing of this one was just right. And maybe the complaint about the length is that's just a really long time to be depressed. But, you know, there's not a whole lot we can do about that, people. These are dark times.
Well, the movie picks up with Bill Skarsgård, who is not Pennywise in this. His eyes are it's awful to say, but the entire time he was praying at the prayer log, I was just thinking, is that one eye going to drift? Is he going to drift that eye? Oh. And he didn't. And so, but it's, you know, he's coming back from World War II. He's got his own problems. Mm. He meets a woman in a diner, Pulp Fiction style. We cut from that to Jason Clarke meeting a young waitress server in this diner in, you know, late 40s, early 50s, in the middle of bumfuck nowhere. And he is, how would you describe Jason Clarke in this movie? I thought he maybe gave the best performance. I thought everybody was great. There was something about what he was doing where he was just, because to me, like, they cast him as John Connor not that long ago. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense to me. This guy's not John Connor. When I saw him in this as a serial killing, like, photography pervert, I was like, that is perfect casting. There's something just kind of dirty and kind of sloppy about him, you know?
Yeah. He's very greasy in this movie.
Yes.
He's just, like, he's got a layer of filth on him that is never going to come off.
Yes.
He's just... Yeah, I would agree with you. He has, if not the best, then like one of the very best performances in this movie, because he truly, like, I now accept that that's him.
Yes.
Like, it was so believable. Yeah.
Like, I think Pattinson's a good actor, but every time he's on screen, I'm like, that's Robert Pattinson. You know what I mean? And Pattinson's like weird televangelist kind of accent that's felt like 20 years ahead of time of what it should have been, you know? It's a little odd. And the whole time I was just sort of like, okay, that's Robert Pattinson. And it wasn't bad, but Jason Clarke, at a certain point, I'm like, this guy's a fucking greaseball. And he feels like a real leering, controlling pervert coming loose at the edges, like frayed at the edges. And like, he seems like the sort of guy who would really pick up young hitchhikers on the side of the road and try to have them take weird photos with his wife before and after he murdered them.
He felt very real.
Yeah. And I don't, who was the actress that played opposite him, that played his wife? I don't know if I've ever seen her in anything.
I think that was Riley Keough, right?
Oh yeah. She was in, was she in Mad Max, Fury Road?
Yes, she was, and I just watched that on Sunday.
So then we've got the one bride shows up in Lovecraft Country. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Zoe Kravitz is taking over the world.
Everywhere.
And then we've got this young lady in this. So, like, the brides of Morton Joe are making their way in Hollywood. It's interesting to see.
Yeah.
The thing that stuck out to me, and you were brave enough to actually watch it twice, and I was not.
Yes.
but the thing that stuck out to me in watching it was the movie, without saying it, seems to have a lot to say about the dynamics between men and women and those who have power and don't have power. I made a joke about it, but Deputy Sheriff, you know, he's the law. His first introduction is him... not really coercing, but having some sort of clandestine relationship with somebody in his cruiser. You have obviously the relationship between, I think probably the one it represents the least is probably Skarsgård and his wife. They seem to be an actual pair.
Yeah.
He seems actually kind of in a way more dependent on her. Like, that relationship helped put him back together.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, but then, you know, obviously the Jason Clarke relationship with his wife, who he's like prostituting his wife and it's weird, man. And she obviously doesn't seem to have a whole lot of power for herself. The kid from Harry Potter, Dursley, who shows up in this, who would be great for a Children of the Corn remake. If they ever do a Children of the Corn remake, the whole time he was on screen, he's kind of got the hunched shoulder on the one side. I'm like, this motherfucker needs to be, you know, Malachi. he wants you.
I could see it.
You're right? Yeah. Like, oh my God. He's like another great performance. He's like this snake handling preacher who shows up in this country bumpkin church with his crippled cousin, and he pours spiders all over his face.
Oh my God.
To claim he's been delivered from his fear of hell. And all, like, it's just like some crazy stuff. And I think if I had to boil it down, like, what is this movie about? To me, it's about it's about power, right? It's about the power that trauma and tragedy has over us. It's about the power of the communities we grew up in, right? It's about the power of religion over us, oppressive forces,
definitely,
the power of men over women, the power of mental illness, the power of sexual exploitation. And really, when your listener said, and everybody is bad. I think that applies to just about everybody but the Arvin character, who's the closest we get to a protagonist, which is Tom Holland, for most of the movie. What do you think this movie's about? What do you think Campos is trying to say? I'm not sure what the novel is trying to say, but what was the main thing you got across from this movie?
I feel like the main thing I was taking away from it was just almost just the ability of people to use religion to take advantage of other people. That's just something that's just something you can see every day in real life all the time. But I felt like it was really, they use different people, different points of their life, different ways that the religion was controlling them, whether it was a preacher shaming them, a preacher, you know, being overzealous and having followers based on that, or just a misunderstanding of religion into, you know, how you think it can bail you out of anything. And that's what we see with Willard, is just like, if I pray enough, the cancer will go away. Yeah. And maybe if I kill my son's dog, the cancer will go away. And it's just, it's these acts of faith that if you take away the faith motivation, make absolutely no sense. Right. And just sort of how that can skew things into making people do things that otherwise they would never do. But you throw religion into the mix and all of a sudden anybody will do anything. And I think it was a big commentary on that and how people use that in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, in particular, men, right? How men have used religion to their own ends, essentially. And I think the movie's really, really stark, because at least four times in this movie, people are like crying out to God to answer their prayers or do whatever. And the camera just lingers and nothing happens.
Yeah.
And by him just like setting the camera, not moving, he doesn't zoom in, he doesn't zoom out, doesn't pan around, just sets the camera, and it's completely, everything in the scene goes completely still. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's some of the most cold, chilling, hopeless.
Yeah.
You know, when
it feels hopeless.
It's hopeless. Yeah. When, the snake handler, played by Dursley, I forget his character's name, but when he's, he comes out of his prayer closet, stinking to high heaven and saying, I know what God wants me to do. I'm filled with the Holy Ghost. I know what's going to happen. And he takes the most innocent, naive wife of all time. We're going to go for a walk. And they just like, they're walking. And some of the color correction and the way they chose to shoot this and the way they choose to saturate and desaturate and the production design as far as the clothes that people wear. I mean, there's a weird elegance to this, right? So at one time, kind of thematically, the movie feels like this protracted elegy. It feels like a road trip, and every little road stop, rest stop, you stop on your road trip, there's another tragedy there, you know? It's like you got in a car, and you're like, I'm driving from Ohio to Florida. And then you had to drive through West Virginia, and every few miles, you know, every 50 miles, you stop to gas up or whatever it was. Or, you know, pee or whatever. And it's like, well, I stop here and there's somebody dying of cancer. And I stop at this next part of the journey and somebody's being sexually exploited by their pastor. And somebody's being shamed for being poor by their pastor. And somebody just killed his wife and thinks that God is going to give him the power to raise her from the dead. And every time God doesn't answer, you know, every time.
He's dark.
No, they never get bailed out. There is no good thing that happens to anybody, right? Like,
no, like at all.
Like Lenora is abandoned as a baby because her father murdered her mother in a belief that God told him to do it because God was going to give him the power to raise her from the dead. So we don't even get the impression this guy hates his wife or even was like particularly mistreated her. Right? We never see that.
Like, he really thought it was going to work.
He really thought if I stab her in the neck with a screwdriver, she's going to come right back and we'll just get back. We'll just keep going on this walk, right? And then, if anything, you know, now we have this great testimony to take around to some tent revival or whatever, you know?
Exactly.
And it just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. And then like his end is he's like, I need to go home and make it right with my daughter. And I did a terrible. So he kind of comes to his senses a little bit. And of course he gets picked up by Jason Clarke and his psychopath girlfriend. And, yep. And he's like the first one they murder in some kind of weird porno thing. And I was just like, oh,
yep.
This movie.
Yeah, like bad things just keep happening to people.
Just piling up.
But never in a way that, like what you just described, you'd think that would feel like better. Like, oh, the guy who killed his wife. Well, he got killed. Good. He got his. And it's like, it doesn't feel that way at all because he's like, even though he's done something terrible, his motivation, although insane, you know, was not to kill her. And he is trying to come back to Lenora. And reasonably, he would go to jail if he ever got back to her and told everybody what happened. But you don't feel better that he gets killed by them. Like, not at all. It just seems like worse on top of worse. Like, everything just keeps piling on. And then Lenora gets bullied when she's older. Like, she can't have anything. And she's just... She's like her mother. Like, she's so just sweet and just trying to see the best in people. Talks about her dad coming back to her one day because obviously she doesn't know what happened to him and has already forgiven him in case that something happened to her mother. Like, sight unseen. Like, she's just the...
Well, that's the thing is, like, most of the women in this movie are innocent souls, right? For the most part.
Yeah, with the exception of Riley Keough's character, all the ladies are lovely.
Yes.
And...
but even her, to some extent, she's kind of a victim too, because kind of, you know,
she does attempt to leave a few times and she, you know, says to her husband, like, I don't like it anymore,
but she keeps on doing it.
Yeah, she keeps doing it. And then we do have that scene before her brother comes to see her where she's looking fondly at the photos of presumably some of the men in the photos are dead. And they all did end up dying. So she's looking fondly back at murder.
Well, at one point, she like has a six-pack of beer, Bush Light or whatever, in her hand. She goes to a payphone. She's like, you're going to find a young soldier. He didn't go AWOL.
Yeah.
He got chopped up and put in a suitcase on the side of such and such road.
Yeah.
That hangs up the phone. And so...
She does call that last one in.
Yeah, but they chopped him up and put him in a suitcase first.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
It's pretty bad. So it's like, okay, you're not pardoned because you like, redeemed his honor or whatever so they could find his remains. Like, you probably helped your husband chop him up and put him into...
Probably.
And the thing is, all of this, like, if you have no idea what fucking movie we're talking about and you're just listening to a podcast on your way to work with your kids... first of all, I'm sorry. Second of all, you know, the Pepsi cup thing should have tipped you off to turn this off. Third, all of this is played flat. It's not flashy. It's not like a Rob Zombie movie where it's like, look at all this gore. You know, it's like,
no, it's not quiet.
It's quiet. This movie is... borderline sterile. I don't mean that in a bad way. It's like very open. It's very spacious. The shots are very spacious. It's very it plays like a funeral dirge. It plays like a tragedy in the truest sense of the word, because the woman who was abandoned and you know her dad, even though he murdered the mom, is almost as much a victim of the religion as anybody else, because he's taken it, as illogical as it is, he's taken these beliefs almost to their most logical conclusion, right? Like, he may be uneducated, he may be unstable, but he thinks that he's hearing God, and he hears these stories, and he's literalizing them to the point that it's empowering him to do these things to the outside look insane, but you never look at it, he doesn't strike you as a phony, as opposed to the other preacher we get in the movie, played by our boy Edward, Robert Pattinson, who is just, the moment he's on screen, is like, oh, this guy is like a sociopath, phony. This guy's a predator, right? One's a fanatic, but he's a true believer. Doesn't get him off the hook. The other one, it doesn't believe any of this shit that's coming out of his mouth. He just knows exactly what to say to manipulate people around him.
Yeah, definitely.
And then this daughter, this innocent baby we see grow up, is the person caught in between these two constructs of faith, and she meets the same fate, like you said, as her mom, because Pattinson ends up manipulating her and using his position to sexually assault and victimize her, then convince her it's all her fault and she's crazy, try to convince the entire town she's crazy, to where she ends up killing herself because she goes from this pure, innocent, true believing, virginal sweetheart of a young girl. She's a young girl. She's in high school and is totally just absorbed by this predator. It's uncomfortable to watch, to be honest with you. I mean,
And hers is one of those fates. It's like so upsetting in this movie because they don't ever explain it, because only us as the audience and the narrator knows that Lenora changed her mind at the last second and didn't want to kill herself. We're the only ones who know that. Nobody else in the movie knows that. Like, and nobody else in the movie ever could know that. Like, it just is left at that. It's so tragic. Like, nobody gets a good thing to happen to them.
No. Like, so then when the medical examiner does the autopsy, then they discover she's pregnant. And so we're talking about 1957, rural America, small towns, you know, and everybody knows everybody's business. And that's almost like the movie almost feels like the narrator is like a detached resident of these communities who just happens to know the oral history of these families.
Yeah.
And you're like sitting at some like kitchen table on a foggy morning or a late evening, and everybody is just smoking, chain smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee or bourbon, and is sitting there telling you like this horrible tragedy, this multi-generational tragedy that happened. And that's really what it feels like. And every once in a while, he'll make a little witticism here and there, but it's almost all like just told from a distance, you know? And so you're just like, you're hearing about these people's lives. And in that time, in that place, like even her reputation is destroyed, right? Because she's a young girl who was pregnant out of wedlock. And then there's obviously some inferences made there because they're not Arvin, who ends up going to live and is raised with her, really does see her as a sister. But there's jokes made in the community that they're sleeping together. So then there's a little bit of, you know, well, maybe it was Arvin, you know, because what other man would have done this? And it's like, oh, my God, you know. And so it's like
it's just all so bad.
And she is the one person he truly loves and cares about in this world, because his mother, who he loved, is gone. His father, who he did love, he is angry and blames for crucifying his favorite dog. And killing himself on the day of his mother's funeral. And so he's got all this internal anger. And then, of course, when he figures out, he blames himself because he wasn't there to protect her, which is what he sees his role as being. And the one death that I do feel is cathartic is when he just puts a couple of bullets right into Robert Pattinson. That was cathartic.
Yeah. That
motherfucker had
it coming. The only time. Yeah. That's the only time that you're like, oh, good. Good. I'm glad that happened. But every other time is you're just like, oh no, it's getting worse. Like, no. But that one's all right.
Yeah. Do you normally I know you've talked about some of the movies you watch and you at the beginning of the pandemic. Do you normally have a taste for these sort of weird hillbilly elegies?
So I am beginning to realize that I don't know my own taste. So I've always kind of accepted about myself that, like, I don't like scary movies. I don't like movies that are very violent. I don't like movies where, like, really upsetting things happen. Like, that's just not what I like. And then I think about the movies I've been watching the past couple of years, and I like a lot of movies like that. Like, I don't know if it's just, like, throughout time I've, like, loosened up on what I'm willing to watch. Because I honestly didn't see a, quote-unquote, horror movie in the theaters until I saw The Nun like a year and a half ago. ever. And then here's the thing about The Nun is I was so scared of it the entire time, and after I walked out I realized it was rated PG-13 and I was so embarrassed.
So what you're saying is the Lady Wan will not be making an appearance in any body horror episodes of binge movies in the distant future.
So here's the thing. I always thought that about myself, and then whenever I do watch them, I like it. Like this movie, I was talking to my co-host about how I saw this movie and we were going to talk about it. And I was like, I'm going to watch it again. And he's like, you're going to watch it again? And I'm like, yeah, I'm so excited. And he's like, I heard it's like messed up. I'm like, yeah, it is. But he's just sort of like, but you don't like stuff like that. I'm like, I guess I do. Like, I think I'm just, I'm coming to terms with the fact that, yeah, if it's good, that I don't care.
Yeah.
Like it's, I'm on board for some really, really upsetting, depressing things if it is well made and has good performances in it. And like this movie has an amazing soundtrack. Mm. Like I was singing along to songs in this movie the first time I watched it. And I was like, oh, I forgot about this song. Mm. Like they were all just like flooding back to me. And it like fully sucked me into the movie. It's
Are you really, like a low-key really hill person? All of a sudden you know these backwoods bluegrass jug music, because that's what the score is. The score is all of this, like all these backyard hollers, you know, all these weird Irish immigrant, you know, bluegrass songs.
Truly, I don't know why this music was such a big part of my childhood, because that's not where my family's from at all. like not even close, but it is definitely a lot of the music that, you know, my mom was having us listen to when I was a kid. My mom's not even American. Like my mom's from England. So I don't know why this was her jam.
So the lady is not a gimmick. You're a true lady.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm
there
fancy.
There you go. The Duchess won. The Duchess of Florida.
I'll take the title. I'll take the title, but none of the responsibility. Thank you. Just the perks.
The one thing, the one character who I think is sort of underdeveloped in the movie, and my guess is that the novel, and this is just a guess, my guess is the novel probably diverts into a lot more depth into each of these character stories. There's only so much you can do in a condensed 2 hours and 15 minutes, plus or minus.
Yeah.
And so I think they really kind of boiled it down to try to make it with these diversions into these other stories, because the stories do intersect at a certain point.
Yes.
I think they kind of tried to boil it down as much as you could about Arvin and his background and so forth and so on, to try to kind of give you a protagonist, especially in the kind of second half of the movie. Sebastian Stan's deputy sheriff, who's also the brother of the girl who's going around with the photographer who's picking up.
Yeah.
I didn't give a shit about his storyline. I didn't care about his character. If it were a TV show, his episode would have been the one I was like, eh.
So I wasn't following all the connections with him the first time I watched it. I have to say, watching it a second time was much better for understanding how intersected all these stories are, especially with like Arvin's parents meet at the exact moment that, you know, Riley Keough and Jason Clarke meet, and like how that interplays in their lives. Like it's like he is going to kill these people who met on the same day that his parents met. Like that's wild. That's completely insane. But it's much more fun to watch the second time around, because you can kind of see like how they're going to circle back around each other. They're all like, you know, sort of revolving around each other in this little weird backwoods universe. But I didn't fully grasp Sebastian Stan's sheriff character through the whole first half of the movie. He kind of felt like he showed up in the second half to me. And then watching it the second time, I was like, oh, right, that was him. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. I kind of see what he's doing. Like, his first run at becoming sheriff was, like, kind of a throwaway, and it's more about his re-election later and, like, covering up what his sister is getting into and how he's corrupt. But it feels a little rushed with him. It feels underdeveloped in the first half and then rushed in the second half, especially given, like, our big ending is Tom Holland and Sebastian Stan. Like,
that's what I'm saying.
I'm so much more invested in Tom Holland.
Right.
And he doesn't even show up until 48 minutes into the movie.
Right.
That actor.
Right. That's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, obviously, we have to make the focus more on Arvin, right? And then these diversions and how these lives connect. But then the last two characters in the movie, the standoff at the end, it all boils down to, everybody else is fucking dead. It all boils down to these two guys. And
Yeah.
And I love the aspect of, it's a little novelish, it's a little bookendy, I get it, but I like that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That the guy who showed up, you know, to not really comfort him because he was kind of a prick the entire time.
Yeah, he wasn't very nice.
No,
at all.
But the guy that like showed up to the scene when he when his father committed suicide, mm-hmm. and like the cop that was answered the call is the guy who he's going to try to kill him at the end of the movie. They're going to try to kill each other
in the same
in the
spot.
Same spot. Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I dig that, right? I dig that. I'm all for it. I get it. We're back to the prayer mm-hmm. log. It's all come full circle. All of these lives, all these stories have intersected and come to their end. And who's going to get out of this alive and not? And then, but I think I would have cared so much more if I gave a shit about Sebastian Stan's character, or if I'd been able to mm-hmm. connect with him at all. I never felt like I really got inside that character at all. Like, I don't give a fuck about you running for sheriff of some podunk town. And like, the corruption was never really, it's like hinted at. He gets bribes from a guy who's running a whorehouse out of a bar. And that's really all I know about him. So maybe you've seen it twice. Maybe you're smarter than I am. Was there anything I missed with that character, or was it really as rushed as I felt?
No, I would say that it feels, like I said, it feels rushed in the first half and then like, just kind of light in the second half. I not to like make this what I do on my show, but if I had to fix this, I would have him actually be a good sheriff up until he's covering up the fact that his sister is a serial killer. Mm. You know, then there's some conflict there, because you can look at it as, well, it's not just about his reputation. It's about and the election and his job and his power, but it's about not wanting everyone to find out that his sister was a murderer. Like, she's already dead. There's no reason for people to then find that out about her. Like, she's gone. Like, let it be. But the fact that he starts off the movie, like, as you said, with the Pepsi cup, he's already immediately presented as gross.
Yes.
And then that he's doing like the bribes with the shady businessmen and like looking the other way at different things. Like, if there was something good to him and there's something good to Arvin, then we can have them circle back to each other at the end of the story. And at least there's some give and take there, but he's done absolutely nothing good. And like you said, he doesn't even comfort Arvin as a child when his dad has killed himself and his mother's funeral was that day. Like, this kid is having the worst day ever. And you're just like, yeah, well, one day my dad walked out, so it is what it is. Like, oh, that's what you're doing with this? You're going to make this about you, sheriff? Like, if he had been at least a good sheriff, somebody who did comfort Tom Holland in that, or Arvin as a young child in that moment, and then have it come back later to now it's like a standoff in that same spot, like, that's a lot more dramatic mm-hmm. and like emotional than just like, he was a dick then and now he's trying to kill him, look how stuff got worse. Like,
well, to make the movie even more depressing, but if we went your route with it, right, if he was like the one ray of light in this backwoods hellhole universe these people live in, and he was like the one good guy, and then he breaks bad, right?
Yeah,
he turns, he something happens to him, he's pushed, whatever. You know, the sister, the cover-up, the whatever, he's evil, or he's revealed to be evil, or he's been evil the whole time and we didn't know. But if he had he been presented as a more sympathetic character, and then midway through the film, then we're like, oh shit, even this the one ray of sunshine in the movie is as fucked up as anybody. Then when he confronts Arvin in the same spot, it gets to that drama that you're talking about. Because as it stands, I like the movie, but when we get towards the end, I never really... for a split second, I'm like, they could kill Arvin. This would be the sort of movie where Arvin dies.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's getting it. So, like, nothing seemed off limits.
But then I was like, but I think he's going to get out of this. Because in a weird way, and I could totally be overreading this, but in a weird way, especially in the second half, once he decides to go, like, vengeance, once he decides to go, like, I'm going to beat the shit out of these guys who are harassing my stepsister, essentially, right? Once he does all this violent, heinous shit, letting all of this anger and rage that he's had since childhood out, it's almost as if there's divine providence over his life that it just always kind of works out, where he's just kind of getting by the skin of his teeth. When he, you know, he kills Pattinson's character, and but you know, is somehow still is able to get out of town. His car breaks down, and he gets picked up by the serial killers. But he's quick enough to figure out what's going on, and he gets them before they get him. And it's like, here's this guy who either through the hell of his childhood and maybe even some of the like deranged lessons his battle-scarred father, who saw a crucified Marine, which is just how the movie opens. You're like, oh, no.
This is what you're
in for. This is what you're in for. Maybe some of those lessons actually paid off, and he's like, in a weird way, it feels like if God makes an appearance anywhere in this movie, it's to help this kid survive and kill all these evil people.
Yeah, he is like methodically ridding the world of people who we've seen be nothing but terrible.
And I'd say he's the only one that catches a break. The only one. Not that others like Lenore deserved a break, but she didn't get one for whatever reason. This one kid.
Yeah.
And so it's like this weird poetic thing of like, maybe if there is a God, he heard your prayers, but he didn't choose to intervene in all of this horrific stuff. But for whatever reason, he's intervening now to help you, rid the world of this filth. There's sort of like a weird tonal thing. Even if how like the guy is shooting at him at point blank range and is missing, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, when they're in the woods, right? Sebastian Stan, the sheriff, is shooting right at him, and he can't hit him.
With a shotgun.
Yeah, with a shotgun, and can't hit him. And Arvin is surprised, right? Like Arvin's like, how the hell am I not shot, right?
Yeah.
So it's like it's which is like, what a twisted if there is a God in the universe of this movie, he's a twisted fuck. And I think that's what I think that's kind of what the movie's conclusion is, right? Is that the world is these backwoods towns where everybody knows each other's business and everybody's interlinked and everybody's like the pervasiveness of evil, I guess, if there's a point to this movie. And then even like at the end, like he doesn't want to fall asleep in the car with like the hippie because he's like convinced the hippie's going to try to kill him and rape him. And I'm like, at the end of the movie, I knew it would work because I'm like, don't go to sleep. And I know the movie's going to end, but I'm so concerned. Like as soon as this guy falls asleep, that this guy's going to try to be a rapist or a psychopath or a murderer.
What is going to happen? Yeah. Like, and at the very best, like best case scenario, that ride is uneventful. Like Arvin is for sure going to Vietnam.
Yes.
Like he's that age. The Lyndon Johnson speech is on the radio saying like, we're throwing more troops at this. Like it's happening.
Oh yeah. He's going to go to Vietnam. And that brings it full circle. Like you were saying earlier, right?
Yeah.
That's another full circle moment, which is like whatever the hell that created him is going to swallow him back up again. He was vomited out of the hell mouth of World War II, right, essentially. And war is going to swallow him back up, right? And that it's almost, you know, to use the term, you know, the sins of the father are being passed down to the second, third generation. So there's almost something like that. There's almost this idea or this feeling in the movie that whatever happened to Willard, Skarsgård's character, seeing a crucified Marine in World War II, it fucked this guy up, but it's almost as if he like there was a malignant evil that just at that moment attached itself to him.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it.
Me too. Like, me too.
Like it is full of great performances, and it's shot really well. It feels really real and raw, and like yes, it is very upsetting, but I mean, I would recommend it.
Well, that was my next question. Like, would you recommend it? And I always recommend stuff, you know, with the condition of the world as it is right now, with a little bit of a caveat, which
is it's tough.
If it depends on your mental health, it depends on where you are at and what you can tolerate and what you can stand and what you're wanting to experience. There are some people, and there's nothing wrong with this, that they just view movies as entertainment. I just want to be entertained. I want escapism.
Just popcorn.
Yeah, just want popcorn. Yeah, that's it. And other people are like, yeah. I want to watch a movie to experience something, right? The part of the entertainment is I want to be affected. I want to feel something. I want this to generate some kind of emotion in me. It doesn't have to be a good one. This movie is effective of generating some kind of a feeling that washes over you, but it's not necessarily like entertaining. This is not the feel-good romp of 2020. I don't know what that movie is, but this is not it.
No.
Bad Boys for Life. I don't know.
Oh, I mean, that was a fun one.
That's the best we got in 2020. That's the peak right
that
there.
That is going to be the biggest movie at the box office of the whole year, for sure.
It's going to be, like, it's no going to get nominated for a major award. It's going to have to. So I would recommend it with the caveat of no kind of, but now you know, and because we just talked all about it.
Yeah.
But if that sounds like something you're interested in, then you'll probably like the movie. If not, then you can't say we didn't warn you.
Yes. Oh, I mean, and the movie warns you off the bat. Like, this is Netflix. You are not trapped in a theater. You can turn it off if it's too much for you in the first 5 minutes, because if it's too much for you in the first 5 minutes, you absolutely should turn it off, because it's going to get worse.
Well, we're playing checkers. The Lady Juan is playing chess, because she was like, oh, you could just turn it off, which has never occurred to me. Or apparently most people in the world are like, oh, I could just turn this off. No, we just hate watch it and then be like, that was terrible and offensive. I watched every last minute of it. That's why we have you on, though. So here's what I want the Binge Lords to do. I want you to, if you've seen the film, if you've enjoyed it or you hated it, you can tweet at us at Binge Movies, or what is your handle, The Lady One?
It is The Lady One, THELADYWAN.
Tag both of us and say, you sick fucks, I watched this with my 5-year-old and now they're horribly scarred on your recommendation. And we'll say, what's wrong with you? And then we'll collaborate behind the scenes and call child services, because we told you there is a literal crucified flayed skin Marine in the first 5 minutes of this movie. Yeah. And it gets worse from there. So please don't let your kids see this. Put some parental controls on your Netflix, for fuck's sake. Come on.
Grown-ups only.
Yep. So if our Binge Lords want to hear more of your voice and of your fixing of movies, where should they go?
You can find me on Screen Fix. You can find the show on screenfixpod.com. We're on Instagram and Twitter at screenfixpod. You can hit us up there anytime.
That's perfect. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. Listen to their show, subscribe, leave them a 5-star review. Tell them Binge Movies sent
please.
You. And we hope to have you back. Now, here's the thing. This bourbon's almost gone. Okay, it's mostly water now. I had to cut it with a little bit of ice. Okay. Ooh. You created something. I think you created it. You coined the phrase movie juice.
I named it, yes.
Okay. Describe what that
movie
is.
Movie juice. It is. Movie juice is the perfect pre-movie cocktail back in the days when you used to, you know, maybe get a drink before you went to the theater, you know, ages ago when that was a thing we did. But it also works for at home. It is cold brew and bourbon.
Do you have a preferred bourbon that you would recommend?
I prefer it with Buffalo Trace, but I will also do Bullet, because sometimes Buffalo Trace is a little hard to track down.
I was about to say Buffalo Trace is impossible to find. Yeah.
When I find it, though, it is. Yeah. Buffalo Trace, Bullet, and then Maker's Mark always works, too.
You introduced me to this concept called movie juice, which is, like I said, giving me heartburn again for the first time in years. So we're going to have to switch it up. I've given you a task. I've given you a challenge. It's twofold. One, you have to come back on to the main show, and you're going to have to watch a lot of fucking movies. You're going to have to review all of them, rate all of them. We're going to have a protracted conversation about all of your opinions. We're going to have to go deep. I want you to fix every movie that we talk about. So we have to have you back.
Okay.
A second task that I've given you, a second challenge I've put forward to you. If you want to retain your title as the First Lady of Binge Movies, these are the challenges. You have to create a Binge Movies official cocktail with vodka, preferably Tito's. We're a Tito's family.
I am also Team Tito's.
We knew we liked you. So, by the time you appear, if you are still willing to.
I am.
on a future episode, you have to show up and debut your new cocktail. And even though we'll probably record it at 11 o'clock in the morning, we'll mix it up and we'll make it and we'll day drink as we talk about movies.
I love it. It sounds like my perfect day.
Because you and I have talked about what we may be covering in the not too distant future, and it's a lot of material, and we might just need some day drinking to get through that episode.
Absolutely. We're going to do this. I'm all in. I'm all in.
Whatever it takes.
Yes.
All right. Well, please follow Lady Juan on social media. She's a great follow. She's a big Taylor Swift fan. Please don't hold that against her. She's a great podcaster. She's got a great show. She's been on a bunch of other podcasts. She's hilarious. She's insightful. She's the first lady of binge movies. Our first female guest. Give it up to her. And don't be a fucking creeper on the internet, you fucking weirdos. Please don't. If I find out you're a fucking creeper, you're excommunicated from binge movies. I'm not joking. Please don't fucking do it.
Yeah.
Come on.
Be polite.
Come on. Be polite. Please, for the love of God.
But follow me.
All right. It was great having you on, and we look forward to drinking the first official cocktail of binge movies with the first lady of binge movies, the Lady Juan, in the not too distant future. Until next time, binge on.